Gallipoli, the Somme, Passchendaele. Perhaps these are the places that spring to mind when you think of New Zealand and the First World War, not, say, Wellington. But there are numerous sites right at our doorstep that can tell us of New Zealand's experiences on the home front during the First World War. Actually, not far from us, on Adelaide Road near the Basin Reserve, sits this building, which was the National Hat Mills, a large hat factory. And to help you get your bearings, it's across the road from the McDonald's, or right next to the After Hours Pharmacy and Medical Centre. So National Hat Mills were the country's largest wartime hat manufacturer. And thousands of hats, the lemon squeezers that we know so well, and caps, were manufactured and dispatched from this purpose-built factory and store. So we've drawn upon sites such as these and others across the country to tell the story of New Zealand's home front experiences. We want to begin today with a bit of an introduction on how we came to work on this project and the people who helped us along the way. And we'll then get stuck into the heart of our book by talking about some of our favourite stories and sites, and then we'll open the floor to questions.
So our journey working on this project began in late 2010, when our then chief historian Bronwyn Daly presented us with a unique challenge: to write a book about historic sites in New Zealand related to the First World War. She thought together we had the right mix of skills, drawing on my past experience researching and writing books and Imelda's background in the heritage sector. We looked at each other. Neither of us had a background in military history, but we were up for the challenge. We had a fairly wide brief, and we were left to work out the details on our own. What is a First World War heritage site in New Zealand, we asked ourselves. New Zealand, of course, lacks any place where bullets were fired in anger. For the interested Kiwi still has to board a plane to walk through those sacred places. But we quickly discovered there were many sites here with important and interesting stories to tell. We quickly adopted the guiding principle that the sites should tell the story of New Zealand's home front experience in all its complexity, rather than be limited, say, to a compendium of purely military sites. Military training camps and fortifications should be considered alongside sites associated with conscientious objectors and wartime dissent. Dairy factories, where food for the troops was produced, should be back-to-back with stories telling sites telling the stories of parents' grief at farewelling sons and places where fundraising was carried out. Soldier settler farms will be set against the graves of those unfortunate souls who committed suicide after returning from war and the mass memorialisation of the 1920s. This approach made for a book quite unlike anything either of us had ever worked on before. So here we have Dave Vert, a former dock ranger up in Auckland, showing Imelda and I around the South Battery up in the North Head fort complex. Identifying the sites was an interesting challenge. We began by calling upon colleagues at the Ministry for Culture and Heritage and experts in the heritage sector, such as Heritage New Zealand and dock people like Dave, and they told us of many sites which we may never have come upon on our own. We also used conventional archival sources to pinpoint where key buildings had been and figure out if they were still there. Where possible, we would take a virtual drive down the relevant street on Google Street View, an unscientific method but usually an effective one. If there's a giant pack and save car park on the site, then it's a pretty good indication the drill hall's probably gone. Finding the sites was like an ongoing detective story, and we were always chasing rumours and hints, as were the research assistants that helped us along the way.
Usually a history book is something made in the archives, leafing through old files, books and newspapers, and so it was in the early stages of this project. But it eventually took us somewhere historians seldom venture in search of their material, into the great outdoors. Gardening gloves, sturdy boots, unfashionable but practical hats, topo maps, sun-blocking camera visors, and occasionally high-vis vests are not usually in the historian's toolkit. But writing about heritage sites forces a new outlook on the timid historian. To your sense of curiosity, you must add a sense of adventure. And so in this photo, you can see, after wading through quite a lot of puddles at Featherston Camp, and a few river crossings, my shoes actually fell apart as Tim and I were trekking up to a hill that looked out over where Trentham Camp was. And yeah, I had to make the walk back down in very uncomfortable shoes. So now we've given you a bit of background as to how the book came about, we'd like to take you on a whistle-stop tour of some of the sites we've included. We wrote the book as a series of themes, so we'll talk to you about just a few of the sites that appear in each.
The first theme relates to the outbreak of the war and the struggle to maintain a flow of soldiers to the front over the following 4 years. So the war began in New Zealand in August 1914 when the governor formally read the declaration of war. Here we see him, this is him here, reading the declaration on the steps of the Parliamentary Library. The reason why it was read there is because Parliament buildings had burnt down in 1907, and the neighbouring library became the de facto official government building for that period. Current parliamentary buildings were opened in 1918 and dedicated as a memorial to those who died in the war. The debating chamber features carved wreaths commemorating First World War battles. Thousands of men signed up for military service straight away, and the influx of men was handled by Defence Department officers across the country. Most towns of any size had a drill hall like this one in Milton, where the men could go to enlist and get their medical inspection done. Each of these small drill officers came under one of the country's four military districts, so you had a reasonably large headquarters office in Auckland, Palmerston North, Christchurch and Dunedin. Here's the Dunedin one, which is the only one of the four headquarters buildings which still stands, and it's in St Andrew's Street. This might be more familiar. Recruits fell short in 1915, so in 1916 the government introduced conscription. This building in Taranaki Street, here in Wellington, of course now the Les Mills Gym, was where the men were called up from. They didn't hold the ballot itself there, but they processed all the paperwork and dispatched calling up notices and so on from there. The appeals of those who didn't want to go were heard in regional courthouses, like this one, the former Auckland Magistrates Court in central Auckland. And those whose appeals were rejected, but who still refused to serve, faced a 2-year prison sentence in one of the country's main prisons, including Mount Eason Prison in Auckland. Others managed to slip through the clutches of the military authorities, like Vincent Carroll, whose grave in Rangatira Cemetery we see here. He took to the West Coast bush in 1917, where he hid with two friends through much of that winter. That November, he was fatally injured after a tree branch fell on his head, and his two friends were in prison for deserting the army once the case became known. The friends told the Greymouth Court that the three of them had discovered, quote, "We were of the same opinion regarding the Military Service Act, which brought in conscription, and decided to go away into the bush. Our object was to keep out of the way." Our next theme concerns the process of actually training the men who went to war. And for those who did enter military service, they could expect 4 months training in a New Zealand training camp. Here we see Trentham Camp in about 1916, initially the camp where most recruits from across the country would train. From 1916, it could house 7,150 men at a time when the whole of the Upper Hutt County had only 1,400 residents. Here's a ground plan of what the camp appeared in 1917-18. The camp is surrounded by rifle ranges and training grounds here down here, which is where the golf course is now. You have training trenches, more training trenches up here, rifle ranges, obstacle courses and so on, and the parade grounds were down in here somewhere. Trentham is still an active military camp, so there's not much left of the First World War buildings. One of the few surviving examples is the former Church of England Institute, which was a place where soldiers could go to seek spiritual advice, write a letter, hear a talk, or play indoor games. All the major churches ran institutes like this during the war. In 1916, the government built a second major camp at Featherston, which was even larger than Trentham. Featherston could house up to 9,850 men at a time when Featherston town itself had only 1,100 residents. And Masterton, which was the biggest town in the Wairarapa, had only 5,000 residents at that time. And the camp also had stabling for 500 horses. Once again, we have the huts here through the centre and left of the photograph. Here we have the workshops, the administration complex. And here we have private shops. You could buy a watch or a book or get some washing done down in here. Canteen and religious institutes back here. Just as the very start of what, by the end of the war, was a huge complex of hospitals and dental surgeries and that sort of thing. And over here, in the very distance, we have Canvas Camp, which was where the men spent their last couple of weeks before they tramped over the Rimutakas to harden them up. The site was cleared after the war, and it was used as a Japanese prisoner of war camp in World War II, but there's still a lot remaining on the site today. This rifle range butt was built in early 1918 for small arms and machine gun training. This fence over here is a typical farm fence, so that gives you a sense of the scale, how large this thing really is. A lot of the old Featherston buildings actually still survive, because they were sold for removal when the camp was closed in the 20s. This is the former infectious diseases hospital, where sick men were quarantined from the rest of the camp population to stop disease from spreading. It was shifted to the Pukiora Sanatorium near Waipokerau in 1921 to become a ward for returned servicemen with tuberculosis, and has passed through many changes of use as the hospital function changed over the following decades. Today, the whole sanatorium complex has become a winery, the Pukiora Estate, and the old hospital has found a completely novel use. The front half in here is the wine tasting room, decorated with corks and wine barrels, and the back half is the owner's residence, where their preteen daughters sleep amongst teddy bears and Justin Bieber posters. Every group of recruits who trained at Featherston Camp marched over the Rimutakas and back to trench them at the end of their training. The second night of this expedition was spent sleeping in the open, and in the morning they carried out a mock battle to practice what they'd learnt during their training. They'd head down into the Mangaroa Valley near Trentham, where one group would take out defensive positions on the hill and the other half would attack them at dawn. The attackers had to capture a bridge and this tunnel, Cruikshanks Tunnel, which was then on the Wairarapa to Wellington railway line. It was practice in protecting and seizing key strategic positions, though unlike the Western Front, an umpire blew a whistle to call proceedings to a halt once the tunnel had been seized. Today, it's abandoned in the middle of someone's farm. The soldiers were given leave every week, and the Trentham and Featherston recruits were given nights out on the town in Wellington. The camp authorities were anxious about these leaves because they were worried the men would visit prostitutes and become infected with venereal disease, meaning they would have to be kept back until they could be treated. Venereal disease at that time was the most common medical complaint amongst new recruits after common colds and flus. So Emily Thomas was one of Wellington's best known prostitutes in 1916, and a legal loophole prevented the authorities from prosecuting prostitutes like Emily, who are running a so-called one-woman brothel. We know more about Emily's operation than about any other, because she was murdered in December 1916, and the police left this rather wonderful sketch of the crime scene. Emily ran her operation from the small shop on the corner of Cambridge Terrace and Tennyson Street, which is now Tony's Tire Service, not the same building. And it's right beside the statue of Queen Victoria. So here we see Emily and her murderer who committed suicide after killing her. So this one-woman brothel is a shop on the Cambridge Terrace here selling sweets and fruit and other small things like cigarettes. And customers, we assume, would make some prearranged signal to Emily, the shopkeeper, and be brought out into the boudoir. You might notice that the sketch is not really to scale. Here we have the shop, and here we have the bed. And here we have chairs. just to give you a sense. So you see, it was a fairly basic bedroom with furniture, a fireplace, a bed, and a washstand behind a screen. Customers could exit out the rear onto Tennyson Street for a discreet exit. Soldiers who did contract venereal disease were sent to the old quarantine station on Quarantine Island in Otago Harbour, where they were treated away from the civilian population. So this is the quarantine barracks here. An armed guard patrolled the island to ensure no one came or went and except on official business, although people being treated there were rumoured to be swimming across to Dunedin for a night on the town. The third theme concerns the forts on the New Zealand coastline designed to repel enemy attacks. So New Zealand was sending its young men overseas to fight in huge numbers, but it still tried to keep its own coastal forts at least theoretically operational in case of attack. New Zealand had fort complexes in the four main harbours to protect the country from raiders who might attack the ports to try and disrupt trade and upset the population. Here we see Fort Jervois, which unusually was located on a small island in Lyttelton Harbour. Most of them were located on hillsides overlooking harbour entrances. This plan shows a bird's eye view of Fort Jervois. Like most of the harbour forts, it had a mixture of 6-inch and 8-inch cannon. These circles here are the gun pits, designed to damage enemy warships, and smaller quick-firing guns designed to hit men and landing crafts and so on. It was always an open question as to whether these forts could actually stop a German warship, but at the very least they could act as a disincentive. There would be no easy pickings here. All the larger guns were so-called disappearing guns, like this one at in the Lighthouse Battery at Fort Tairoa on the Otago Peninsula, which is now part of the Royal Albatross Colony. The gun was loaded under the cover of a shield and then lifted out of its pit to fire on this hydropneumatic lifting apparatus here, which also rotated. So none of these guns were ever fired in anger. But each harbour had a contingency plan to bring them into service at short notice. By the latter years of the war in particular, it was pretty unlikely New Zealand would have had the manpower to successfully repel an enemy attack. The government decided it was far more important to send the men to the front than to keep them at home to keep these guns operational.
In our next theme, we turned our attention away from the experiences of the men and women who served at home and abroad during the First World War to the experiences of civilians. Stories for this theme took us to the places where men left from and family, friends and the public bid farewell, such as homes and halls, wharves and railway stations. This memorial at Cave in South Canterbury recalls the route that men from Cave and the surrounding areas took to get to war. The inscription, which you can hopefully read as well, begins, "So long as the rocks endure and the grass grows and water runs, so long will this stone bear witness that through this low pass men from these districts rode and walked on their way to the great European war." During the unveiling ceremony in April 1928, the ceremony's chairman emphasised the district's appreciation of those who offered their all by leaving the shop, forge, plough, shearing sheds, musterers' camps, or the harvest field. This theme also took us to the places where family and friends obtained information about what was happening once men rode, walked, or sailed out of sight. From newspaper and post offices to libraries and reading rooms. So, for example, one place Dunedinites could get war-related news and information was the city's public library in Moray Place. Centrally located, it was very accessible, open from Monday to Saturday from 9 or 10 a.m. to about 9 or 10 p.m., and the newspaper and magazine room was also open on Sundays. Just as important, it was free. When war broke out, the library already had books on the history and topography of the areas of conflict, some of which were very unfamiliar to New Zealanders, and it also received newspapers from England. The library soon expanded its war-related titles to cover things from treaties on the causes of the war to more personal narratives such as Oliver Hogue's Love Letters of an Anzac. But civilians weren't just waiting on information from the front. They threw themselves into contributing to various patriotic causes. Women are perhaps the most synonymous with patriotic activities, but many, many groups, men, women, young, old, rich, poor, rural and urban, contributed what they could. And for bulb growers in the Lawrence and Waitahuna regions of Otago, that meant daffodils. Lots of daffodils. So each spring from 1916, growers from these areas donated their daffodil crops for sale to aid patriotic causes. Simpson and Hart of Weatherstones were among these donors, and this is the hillside of their bulb growing area. In 1916 and 1918, they sent a total of 32,000 blooms from their hillsides to Dunedin to be sold to help fund the work of the Otago and Southland Women's Patriotic Association. And the hillside can still be seen in bloom in spring each year. Before long, those organising farewells for the soldiers also found themselves organising welcome homes. The first significant return of troops were men wounded at Gallipoli who returned on the Woolocra in July 1915. The centenary for that we are rapidly approaching. As well as welcome home functions, a number of communities around the country planted trees that Arbor Day, which fell close to when the men returned, to mark the landings at Gallipoli and the return of the wounded. And that included Eastbourne residents, who now have this quite splendid pahutakawa.
From here we move on to the efforts to supply Britain with food and to keep everything running here at home. New Zealand provided much else than just men. It provided all sorts of goods to Britain to support the war effort, both there and in the various theatres of war. From March 1915, Britain progressively commandeered the bulk of New Zealand's frozen meat, dairy products, and a variety of other items. One of the less well-known items is a tungsten ore called scheelite, which was mined in various parts of the South Island. So here's the Golden Point Stamper Battery in East Otago, one of the places that scheelite was mined during the war. Scheelite was used in the manufacture of armaments, and Britain purchased all the scheelite New Zealand could produce during these years to help manufacture artillery shells and small arms ammunition. Another of the less well-known products New Zealand exported to Britain is baby formula. Here we see the Glaxo factory in Bunnythorpe, where the formula was manufactured. The theory went that it was sometimes difficult to maintain a steady supply of nutritious food to the men in the trenches, so at times of shortage they could drink baby formula. It was packed with vitamins and was warm and satisfying. The country made solid profits from the British commandeer, but by the last 2 years of the war it was getting harder and harder to ensure a steady supply of both workers and raw materials. The West Coast coal mines are a prime example of both these problems, such as the Denniston mines seen here. Coal fueled the railways, steamships, industry and much domestic power supply. Without enough coal, New Zealand would literally stop working. The workers were unhappy, and threats of mine strikes hung over the country during 1917-18. So the situation was very difficult for workers, mining companies and the government alike. But fortunately, things ran fairly smoothly, all things considered.
After more than 4 years, the war finally drew to a close. Bells rang and flags flew in the spring of 1918 as New Zealanders celebrated the surrenders in quick succession of Bulgaria, Turkey, Austria-Hungary, and the armistice with Germany. The celebratory events that sprang up for each of these surrenders and armistice didn't leave much of a permanent mark in the landscape, but there is this pine tree which stands on Smooth Cone, a volcanic outcrop in the Strathtyre region of central Otago. Local roadmen are said to have planted three pines there soon after hearing of the German armistice, and despite what is a pretty rocky and windswept area, one of them grew. Sadly, the end of the war didn't bring an end to death among the country's troops. Indeed, they and other fit, healthy adults were badly hit by the deadly influenza pandemic that swept the country in and around the time of the armistice in November 1918. When unveiled in 1917, this memorial at Featherston Cemetery bore just 18 names of Featherston Camp soldiers who had been buried at the local cemetery. It eventually bore the names of 180 soldiers and nurses, most of them victims of the flu pandemic. Happier times were to follow for most, as over the next year or so, the around 56,000 New Zealanders serving abroad at the time of the armistice made their way home. But those waiting on their horses had no joyful reunions. Shipping shortages and quarantine restrictions meant that only four of the around 10,000 New Zealand horses sent overseas ultimately made the journey home. The lucky horses all belonged to officers and returned to New Zealand in July 1920 after 12 months of quarantine in England. Bess remains the best known of the four horses, most likely because of this memorial dedicated to her at Bulls. She was one of more than 1,000 horses donated for military purposes in 1914, and she was allocated to Captain Guy Poles of the Wellington Mounted Rifles. She served him in Egypt, Sinai, Palestine, and France, and later at the military training school at Trentham, and during his term as headmaster at Flock House. When Bess died near Bulls in 1934, Poles buried her at the site and erected this memorial, which has become a bit of a surrogate memorial for all the horses who didn't return. For those who did wish to celebrate the end of the war and the return of the troops, another opportunity arose in July 1919, the country's peace celebrations, time to mark the signing of the Treaty of Versailles. Celebrations were decentralised because of a coal shortage that made it impossible to transport everyone to the main centres. And so these celebrations were held all over the country, from small towns and rural areas to the main centres. Local residents erected this memorial at the summit of Mount Maunganui in March 1920 to commemorate a beacon fire lit there during the peace celebrations. The blaze at the top of the 232-metre high mount, lit to commemorate peace, as the memorial would later record, was answered by 14 other hilltop fires ranged in a wide ring across the Bay of Plenty. And for those of you who are familiar with Lord of the Rings, that's how I sort of picture these hilltop fires answering each other. In this image, you can see the beacon fire under preparation. The same hardy locals who carried 70 barrels of tar to the summit to fuel the fire later carried up the stones and marble from which the memorial was constructed.
So the government had a big job on its hands, trying to reintegrate the 80,000-odd returned servicemen back into society. It made a big push to get returned servicemen back into work in the years immediately following the war. It offered free vocational classes all over the country in places like the King Edward Technical School in Dunedin. Motor mechanics was by far the most popular vocational subject across the country, and when the government offered cheap loans to get businesses started, motor garages again proved to be the most popular. Ex-serviceman Charles Stanner started this Ford service depot in Eltham in 1921, and it's still run by his descendants today. The government also offered cheap farmland to so-called soldier settlers, helping them get established with development loans. There was perhaps an 80-85% success rate, but the failures of many in the 1920s and 30s have given the soldier settler scheme the taint of failure in the public memory. The best remembered failure is that of the Mangaparua settlement in the King Country, which had been abandoned within a few years of this bridge being completed in 1936. It's a New Zealand icon now as the Bridge to Nowhere. Many men needed ongoing medical treatment following wartime injury and illness, and the government built two military hospitals in late 1915 and early 1916. King George V Hospital in Rotorua, which we see here, and Queen Mary Hospital in Hanmer were built to the same plans. So the idea, as you can see, they each had two octagonal wards connected by a corridor full of offices with a kitchen complex at the back. And here we have doctors' waiting rooms up the top. As well as down here, a third ward, which was also used for as a dining room sometimes. The idea of octagonal wards was that the men could be arranged in a circular fashion, two deep, with a nurse in the centre of the room and a nurse's station where medicine and so on was stored. This is the interior of the surviving ward from the Rotorua Hospital, which was actually moved to Otaki in 1931 to become part of the children's health camp there. The Queen Mary Hospital still stands too. It's in the main street of Hanmer next to the pools. Some men never recovered from the war. This Hutt Valley man, Arnold McGee, shot himself the day after his troop ship docked in Wellington in 1919. He'd been gassed at Passchendaele and his health had got worse ever since. His illness developed into shell shock with shaking, headaches and insomnia. He was sent home after attempting suicide in hospital in England, but it appears his mind was made up. His suicide note explained that the war had destroyed his health and he couldn't foresee a time when his health would ever improve. "The rotten old military authorities can bury me," he wrote. "Goodbye, sweetheart. God knows I love you greatly, your broken old mate. Runny."
By the time official lists of the country's war dead were compiled in 1921, the First World War, one of the deadliest wars in history to that time, had cost New Zealand some 18,000 lives. This was grief and loss on a previously unimaginable scale, and those who had not lost a member of their immediate family had probably lost an uncle, a cousin, or a friend. People who died in the normal course of events were given funerals and buried nearby so friends and family could visit the grave. But most of New Zealand's war dead were buried half a world away, and only a privileged few could afford international travel. In response, New Zealanders created surrogate graves at home. For some, these were inscriptions on family headstones, such as the inscriptions found on this headstone to the Brown brothers at Waikamiti Cemetery in Auckland. Here you can see the names of three brothers: Trooper James Brown, Lance Corporal William Brown, and Private Archibald Brown, on a headstone in the soldiers section. All three of these men died and were buried overseas, while another brother, Arthur, died at home after falling ill on a troop ship, and this allowed his family to bury him at Waikamiti and erect a headstone which remembered all of those brothers. The only Brown brother to serve in the war and survive, Edward, is also remembered on the headstone. He lived until 1970. For others, they found erecting a shrine on a wall or a mantelpiece a way to remember, such as the Coates family home at Ruatuna, called Ruatuna. Edward and Eleanor Coates of Matakoi learned in mid-1917 that their son William, who had been serving in the Royal Flying Corps in Belgium, had been killed in action. William's elder brother Gordon, a future New Zealand Prime Minister, who was also serving overseas, told his mother in a letter that the thought of old Bill was constantly before me and he was more than avenged. Every one of the boys knew about him and they told me afterwards that many a Hun went under. The mantelpiece at Ruatuna still displays the heartbreaking relics of William's war service, a photo of his plane, and his memorial plaque and scroll. It's the plaque and the scroll, which all families who had lost members in war service received from the King in 1921. But the most public expression are the permanent memorials which grace nearly every suburb, town and city. Most individuals and groups erected ornamental memorials such as arches, statues, columns and obelisks, which already resonated with funerary and commemorative meanings. They were also scalable. People of modest means could select a design from a monumental mason's catalogue and complete it relatively easily and inexpensively. So, for example, Foxton residents called upon local Fielding monumental masons to erect this column of red Scotch granite as their war memorial. They placed it on a base of New Zealand granite, which in turn rests on a foundation of plastered reinforced concrete, raising the modest column to a height of about 5.5 metres. It cost the local community about £500 and was unveiled by the local mayor, it's situated in Main Street, to a small crowd in June 1920. The better off could engage an architect or a sculptor to create a more ambitious and expensive memorial. A number of communities in urban areas and some well-established boys' schools engage such professionals. For example, this one at Auckland Grammar School, which towers over the motorway below. The school's old boys called upon architect William Gummer to design an uplifting monument. The octagonal column of Hawkesbury stone, imported from Sydney, stands about 15 metres high and in turn is surmounted by a bronze statue of a man reaching upward, sculpted by Richard Gross. It cost the old boys about £3,500, about seven times as much as Foxton's column. Governor-General Lord Jellicoe unveiled the memorial to a large crowd in December 1922. And the country hasn't finished erecting such memorials. Judging by some examples I've kept a track of over the last few years, months and weeks, there are still plenty who feel the need to honour and remember the country's First World War dead and continue to add to New Zealand's First World War heritage, which we hope we've given you a glimpse of.